Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. Soldier of Fortune by Brett Anthony Johnston. Her name was Holly Hensley, and except for the 2 years when her father was transferred to a naval base in Florida, her family lived across the street from mine. This was on Beechwood Drive in Corpus Christi, Texas. Our parents held garage sales together, threw hurricane parties, went floundering in the shallow, bottle-green water under the causeway. If the Hensleys were working overtime and Holly was staying late for pep squad practice, which meant grinding against Julio Chavez in the back seat of his Skylark, my mother would pick up Holly's younger brother from daycare and watch him until they got home. Sam had been born while they were living in Florida. "My old man got one past the goalie," Holly liked to say. "There's nothing more disgusting." In 1986, the year everything happened at the Hensley house, Sam was 3. Holly was 18, a senior at King High School, and I was a freshman, awkward and shy and helpless with love. Most mornings we walked to school together. Holly's hair would be wet from the shower, her eyes wide and glassy with fatigue. She'd yawn and say, "What's buzzin', cousin?" She liked to drag her fingers along the chain-link fences we passed and to stop at Maverick Market to buy Diet Cokes and steal candy bars. I waited outside, worrying she'd get caught. We talked about what she'd do after graduation. Some days she planned to enroll at the beauty college. Others she wanted to dance at the Fox's Den out by the oil refineries. And about Roscoe, the collie she'd adopted in Florida. She told me how her little brother preferred her Aggie sweatshirt to his baby blanket. I invented stories of girls I'd been with, wild things named Rhonda and Mandy and Anastasia who attended different schools and who, I hoped, might make Holly jealous. Usually she'd just bump me with her hip and say, "You're more of a slut than I am." We never talked about the rumors that she and Julio had let a crowd of kids watch them in bed at a homecoming party, or that she'd recently been spotted leaving the Sea Ranch Motel with Mr. Mitchell, the geology teacher. Even my parents had heard about Mr. Mitchell. My mother said Holly was just trying to get her parents' attention, acting out because of the new baby. My father said she was trouble, and if he caught me alone with her, he'd whip my ass. But I rarely saw her after we got to campus. Holly would disappear into the school's smoking patio, a dismal slab of concrete where stringy-haired surfers and kids with safety pins through their eyebrows loitered, and I would go find Matt Ricard. Matt and I had been friends since elementary. We'd played on the same soccer team, joined and quit Boy Scouts together, leaned despondently against the gym bleachers and watched couples sway at the junior high dances our parents made us attend. In our freshman year, Matt wore sleeveless shirts and tucked the cuffs of his camouflage pants into military boots. He had a pair of fatigues for every day of the week, desert camo, woodland, and blue woodland, tiger stripe and black tiger stripe. For a while, we'd been into guerrilla warfare. We bought Soldier of Fortune magazines, made blowguns from copper tubing, slathered our faces with mud when we crept under the lacy mesquite trees behind his house. We saved our allowances for the gun expos at the Bayfront Auditorium and loaded up on Chinese throwing stars and bandoliers of blank bullets, butterfly knives, and pamphlets on chokeholds and MREs that tasted like gluey chalk. We ate meals with the forks and spoons attached to our Swiss Army knives. Over the summer, though, I'd grown bored and embarrassed by the warfare stuff. My walls had been draped with camouflage netting, and over my bed I'd had a poster of one ninja roundhousing another. But Matt still liked it, so I'd recently told him he could have my cash. He was disappointed in me, I knew, as if I'd defected to the enemy, and probably the reason he hadn't yet come to collect my stuff was a hope that I changed my mind. But I'd already packed everything into my army duffel, and each afternoon I waited for Matt to take it away. I didn't think we'd stay friends much longer. When my father came into my room on a Friday night in early October, I thought he'd say Matt was on the porch. I was on my bed, staring at the acoustic ceiling where the ninja poster had been, and listening to my stereo. My father crossed the room and lowered the volume.
He wore a short-sleeved shirt and a clip-on tie. He'd just gotten off work. He gazed through my window and into the backyard. "Is Matt here?" I asked. "You need to take care of Holly's dog for a few days." "Roscoe," I said. "Make sure he has food and water. Maybe play with him a little." I sat up on my bed. My father's voice sounded frayed, as if I were hearing him from far away. His hands were clasped behind his back. I thought I smelled cigarette smoke on him, but then I realized it was floating down the hall from the kitchen. "Are they heading out of town?" I asked. The Hensleys had a van and sometimes drove to Comfort or Falling Water in the hill country. "Don't go over there tonight," he said. "You can just start in the morning." "Okay," I said. A wind gusted outside. Tallow branches scraped against the side of the house. "If the dog shits on their patio, spray it down with the hose." "Is Mom smoking again?" "She might be, Josh," he said, and put his hand against the window. "Yes, that might be happening." In 1986, my father worked at the Naval Air Station. Most everyone's father did, including Holly's and Matt's, but he was also moonlighting at Sears, selling radial tires and car batteries, which he blamed on Reagan. It was a year the president denied trading arms for hostages in Iran, and the space shuttle Challenger exploded, and Halley's Comet scorched through the sky. It was a year I loved a reckless girl. The year being around my best friend made me lonely. It was a year my mother was working at the dry cleaning plant and trying to quit smoking. I knew she occasionally snuck cigarettes. I'd seen her in the backyard on evenings when my father was at Sears, but she hadn't smoked in our house for months. On that night in October, when the filmy scent of smoke wafted into my room, I could only think that Holly's family was moving again. The last time her father had gotten news of his transfer, they were gone within a week. But they weren't leaving. There'd been an accident earlier that day, something involving Sam, Holly's little brother. My father only knew that Sam had been taken away in an ambulance, and the Hensleys would likely spend a few nights with him at the hospital. He relayed the information in a detached tone, as if summarizing a movie he didn't want me to watch. He'd moved from the window to sit on my bed, where he looked small. He said their mail would be held, and there was a key under the ceramic cow skull on their porch. I tried to remember the last time I'd seen Sam, but couldn't. Maybe the previous weekend, when he and Holly drew on their driveway with colored chalk, or maybe when Mr. Hensley was watering the yard with Sam on his shoulders. In my room, my father kept dragging his hand over his face as if trying to wake himself up. I asked if he knew how Holly was doing, and he said, "She's hurting, Josh. They're all hurting like hell." My mother baked all night, brownies and lemon bars, biscuits and an enchilada casserole. She fried chicken and sliced vegetables and made salami and cheese sandwiches that she quartered into triangles. When I went into the kitchen on Saturday morning, the counter was crowded with foil-covered dishes. My mother was wall-eyed. She poured me a glass of orange juice and put two pieces of cold fried chicken on my plate. "Breakfast of champions," she said. With all the foil, the kitchen was bright and strange. The table was tacky with humidity. My mother shook a cigarette from a pack, then lit it from a burner on the stove. I heard it sizzle. "Liz called last night," she said, and exhaled smoke toward the ceiling. Liz was Mrs. Hensley, Holly's mother. My mother said, "Little Sam is sedated in intensive care." "I don't know what's happening," I said. "He burned himself," she said. "He scalded all over the front of his little body." Sam, my mother explained, had woken with a fever, so Mrs. Hensley kept him home from daycare. He spent the morning watching cartoons and napping on the living room couch. While he slept, Mrs. Hensley was cleaning the house and washing clothes, then decided to make tuna salad for lunch. She put water on to boil eggs. She checked on Sam on the couch, then stepped into the garage to put a load of laundry in the dryer. They had an attached garage, so she left the kitchen door open in case Sam woke up and called for her. She got sidetracked looking for dryer sheets and stayed out there longer than she'd intended. Then she heard her son screaming. He'd pulled the pot of boiling water down onto himself. I felt core, not like I was going to vomit, but like I already had. I pushed my plate away. At Sam's last birthday party, my parents and I had given him a toy garbage truck. Holly gave him a baseball cap that read, "I wasn't born in Texas, but got here as soon as I could." He'd been wearing it when Mr. Hensley watered their lawn. My mother opened the oven, looked inside, and then closed the door. Her cigarette was in an ashtray on the counter, smoke ribboning toward the open window. "That poor family," my mother said. "They're behind the eight ball," I said. It was a phrase my father used. "They sure are," she said. Liz couldn't find Holly until very late. She thought she was off with that Julio. She had pep squad practice, I lied. I saw her when I walked home.
You did?
There's a game this weekend, I said, a big one. Then that's a relief. I worried she was with the teacher again.
I don't think that really happened, the stuff with Mr. Mitchell, I said.
I know you don't, sweetheart. I took another bite of chicken, drained my orange juice. I said, Matt might come over today. I'm giving him all my war stuff.
I'll leave some chicken for you, too, she said. Your father and I are taking the rest to the hospital.
I want to go, I said.
She brought her cigarette to her lips, then stubbed it out. She said, No, Joshy, I don't think you do.
Their house had always been nicer than ours and bigger. Over the years, workers had renovated the Hensley's kitchen and added two rooms on the house's back side, a study and a game room. They had a bumper pool table, thick carpet, and saltillo tile, lights with dimmer switches, and a fireplace.
Who needs a fireplace in Corpus, my father said one night. He was squinting through the peephole in our front door, watching smoke rise from the Hensley's chimney.
Don't try to be something you're not, boy, he told me, and then told me again when they bought an above-ground pool for their backyard right before Mr. Hensley was transferred to Florida. I'd assumed the transfer was a demotion or punishment, but my father said Hensley had applied for it. By way of explanation, he'd only said, They're Republicans, Joshy. While they were away, the Hensleys rented the house to a Catholic deacon and his wife, and when they returned, they paid to have new vinyl siding installed. It was gray with white and black trim, the shades of a lithograph. Until that October weekend, I'd never been alone in their house. It seemed illicit, like when Matt and I paged through his father's Playboys. The darkened rooms made me anxious. I had the sense I would do something I shouldn't, the dangerous and disappointing feeling that I couldn't be trusted. Had there been a route for me to bypass the house and still reach the garage where Roscoe's food was, I would have taken it. But I didn't have the garage door opener. Their automatic door was another extravagance my father resented, so I had to cut through the kitchen. I went twice on Saturday, three times on Sunday. I moved like a thief on each visit, never lingering or touching what I didn't have to. The air in the house smelled of potpourri, cloistered and spiced, and I tried not to breathe. I averted my gaze from the familiar and mysterious artifacts of the Hensleys' lives. And yet I couldn't keep from seeing the coffee table Mrs. Hensley had pulled over to the couch so Sam wouldn't roll off, Holly's Aggie sweatshirt spread over the cushions, little red high-top shoes upturned on the carpet. I pretended not to know the Hensleys and tried to piece together a different family based on evidence they'd left behind. Their son is an only child, I thought. His parents have taken him to a swimming lesson. Or I imagined all of the Hensleys were home in hiding, waiting for me to break or steal something. My heart pumped in my ears. I left the lights off. In the kitchen, the floor tile gleamed. Holly's father had come home briefly Friday night, mopped up the spilled water, and grabbed fresh clothes for everyone at the hospital. The copper bottom pot was in the sink. Four unopened cans of tuna were stacked on the counter. In the backyard, Roscoe always barreled into my legs and knocked me sideways. He jumped as high as my shoulders and scratched my chest through my shirt and licked my hand with his warm tongue. I let him chase me around the pool, and I threw pine cones for him to catch. We wrestled in the grass the way Holly had said he liked. Then I scratched the scruff of his neck until he snored. I fed him more than I should. Before school on Monday morning, maybe because I'd been hoping Holly would appear on her porch and we'd walk to school together, I opened one of the cans of tuna and let Roscoe eat it from a spoon. That evening there was diarrhea all over the patio. At school the story kept changing. Sam wasn't scalded. He drowned in the Hensley's pool. He slipped on a wet floor and hit his head. His brain was swelling. He'd been hit by a car. He'd eaten roach poison. Someone claimed to have seen the geology teacher taking flowers to the hospital, and someone else said they'd been in the faculty parking lot and found him weeping in his truck. On Wednesday, Matt said he'd heard the whole thing was a lie to cover up how Sam had accidentally shot himself with his father's unregistered pistol. We were standing by the statue of a Mustang, the school mascot. Matt was in his blue woodland camos. He said, I bet it was the Luger she showed us. If it was, the kid's toast. Shortly after she returned from Florida, Holly had taken me and Matt into her parents' bedroom and showed us her father's pistol. She'd been babysitting Sam, and we'd been climbing the retama tree in my front yard. We were wearing our camouflage with pellet rifles slung over our shoulders, pretending to be mercenaries. she'd called across the street. "Y'all want to see something cool?" The pistol was a German Parabellum 1908, a semi-automatic Luger. We'd read about them in our magazines. "He burned himself," I told Matt. "He's sedated in intensive care, but he's going to pull through." I made up the last part. The night before, I'd asked my father about Sam, and he told me to concentrate on my schoolwork and not to give Roscoe any more tuna. "I heard he did it in the game room," Matt said. "I heard there's a gnarly bloodstain under the pool table." "You heard from who?" "Jeff Deo," Matt said. "You don't know Jeff Deo," I said. Jeff Deo was a red-eyed senior, a friend of Julio's who'd gotten held back. He wore the same flannel shirt every day, unbuttoned and tattered, and when I passed him in the hall, I smelled the smoker's patio. "We've been hanging out," Matt said. "We've been getting high. If you tell, I'll kick your ass." "You need to come get all of my gear. If you don't want it, I'll throw it away." "Don't take it out on me just because your girlfriend's brother blew his face off." "She's not my girlfriend," I said. "Right," he laughed. "She's dating Mr. Mitchell, and you're with Anastasia from across town." "You're an asshole." "Check the game room," he said. "I heard the stain looks like a pot leaf." Later that night, Mrs. Hensley called. My father was working his shift at Sears, and I was watching television on the couch while my mother smoked beside me. After answering, my mother handed me the receiver and told me to hang up once she switched to the kitchen phone. While she made her way down the hall, I told Mrs. Hensley about Roscoe catching the pine cones I tossed. She thanked me and said Holly would call me once things calmed down with Sam. Then my mother said, "Okay, Joshy, I got it." "Okay," I said, but I just pushed the mute button and stayed on the line. I wanted to hear if Mrs. Hensley would say anything more about Holly, if she'd mentioned Mr. Hensley's Luger. "We're going to Houston," Mrs. Hensley said. "They're moving him to the burn unit at the Shriners Hospital." "Okay," my mother said. "Okay." "I don't know. I don't know if it's okay." "Are the doctors saying anything else?" "You're going to Houston, that's what they're saying. They're saying we can't help him here." I checked out the game room carpet on Saturday morning, then crept through the rest of the house that night. I knew I wouldn't find a bloodstain, just as I knew stealing through their hallways was a betrayal, but I couldn't stop myself. The moonlight canting through the blinds was bright enough in most rooms, but I also used the angle-head flashlight I'd bought at a gun expo. In the near dark, the Hensley's house seemed smaller, not bigger, which surprised me. A fine layer of dust on the surfaces, the marble-top dressers, the pool table's rails, the framed pictures on the walls, shone in the light, reflected it, and made me think of silt on a riverbed. Moving through their rooms gave me a jumpy underwater feeling, as if I were swimming through the wreckage of a sunken ship, paddling from one ruined space to another. I avoided Sam's room. And I'd told myself I wouldn't go into Holly's room, but on Sunday night I did. The moon hung low in the sky, a lurid glow seeping through her curtains and puddling on the carpet. The room smelled of lavender. I'd been in there before, but stripped of noise and electric light, the layout seemed unexpected. Her bed was made, piled high with frilly pillows and stuffed animals, open-armed bears mostly, and a plush snake stretching the length of her mattress. Four silver-framed photos topped her vanity, Holly and Sam in an orange grove, Julio on Padre Island flexing his arms and smirking, Roscoe licking Holly's face with her eyes closed, and a picture of Holly when she was younger eating ice cream with a fork. Green and white streamers were tacked to her closet door, and when I moved too quickly, they fluttered and startled me. She had a banana-shaped phone on her nightstand, and I began worrying it would ring. Or I thought my father would silently appear in her doorway, his eyes narrow with disgust. "Leave," I thought. "Go home." In my chest, my heart was wild as a trapped, frantic bird. And yet I stayed. Outside, Roscoe trotted around the pool. His tags tinkled. Once he started barking, and I dropped to the floor and shimmied under Holly's bed. The Hensleys, I knew, had returned from Houston. I imagined Holly coming into her room and calling someone, Julio or maybe even Mr. Mitchell, to relay news about Sam. I imagined her turning off the lights and weeping and falling asleep with me under her. I considered bolting, trying to climb out the window and into the backyard, but I knew I'd make too much racket. Roscoe kept barking. He was racing from one fence to another. I held my breath. I listened to phantom footfalls, the murmur of floorboards and studs behind the walls, the sad and random noises of an empty house at night. My hands were trembling, so I tucked them between my chest and the carpet.
I still had the same underwater feeling, though now it was as if I were sinking, watching the surface grow blurry and distant. I waited to hit the bottom, to be discovered in the darkness. But the lights in Holly's room never came on, and eventually Roscoe settled down. I pulled myself out from under the bed. I thought of how Matt and I used to crawl on our bellies in the brush behind his house, our faces obscured with mud. It occurred to me that while I was hiding in the Hensley's house, he might be getting high with Jeff Deo, and I felt suddenly and intensely alone. I had an odd sense of erasure, as if I were seeing the set for a play be dismantled. It was disorienting, and now that I'd crossed into Holly's room, I knew I'd return every night. The knowledge left me feeling resigned and melancholy, but also shot through with boldness. Before leaving, I dialed Matt's number on the banana phone, and when he answered, I didn't say a word. My father was off from Sears that Thursday, so when he got home from the base, we mowed the Hensley's lawns. Maybe my mother had asked him to do it, or maybe he'd gotten the idea after finishing our yard. I hoped it meant the Hensley's would return soon. As he pushed our lawnmower across the street, the engine idling, the blades scattering debris like when a Chinook lifts off, I followed him with the rake and bag of clippings. A cold front had silvered the sky, unraveled the clouds. The air smelled briny, and every so often a wind would gust and eddy the fallen leaves. I waited for my father to announce the Hensleys were driving back from Houston, but he never did. While he swept the back patio, I said, "Maybe when Sam comes home, Mom will quit smoking." He leaned the broom against the house and fished his handkerchief out of his pocket, wiped his forehead. Roscoe was snorkeling along the fence line. I looked at my shoes, flecked with cut grass. I said, "Maybe she'll be less stressed, and..." "Josh," he interrupted, "when Sam comes home, he might not look the same. We need to start preparing ourselves for that." I nodded and dragged the rake across the grass. The trimmings jumped like grasshoppers. I thought of the picture in the silver frame on Holly's dresser, the one of her and her brother in the orange grove. Originally, I'd assumed they were in Florida, but now I believe they might have been in the Rio Grande Valley. In the picture, they're holding hands and heading away from the camera so their faces are invisible. It had become my favorite thing in Holly's room. Since Sunday night, I'd lain on Holly's bed, opened her closet to press my nose into her clothes, even spritzed her perfume on my windbreaker so I could inhale her at home. I dialed every number I could think of on her banana phone. My mother at the dry cleaner, my father at the base in Sears, the secretary at King, and the principal, and my own house, then hung up when anyone answered. I never looked in her drawers, and I never stole anything, but every night I considered taking the Orange Grove picture. I could stare at it for hours, imagining where they might go once they stepped beyond the aperture. "He's behind the eight ball," I said. "This kind of thing can tear up a family," my father said. "It can rip even a strong family to shreds. It's not easy to watch." "They need our help," I said. "You're saying we need to..." "We'll help however we can, Josh, but what I'm saying is we're not going to let them drag us into their problems." "I understand," I said, though I didn't. "What I'm saying is when Holly needs a shoulder to cry on, don't let it be yours." But the Hensleys didn't come home. Mrs. Hensley, I knew, called my mother late at night every couple of days, and I kept hoping to wake up and see their van in their driveway, but it never appeared. One night I overheard my parents talking about skin grafts and a neoprene bodysuit that would keep Sam's flesh hydrated, compressed. Their voices were hushed and somber. My father also mentioned how Mr. Hensley's sick leave and vacation days were long gone. Another night I thought they were talking about Sam again, but they were just discussing the breakdown of talks between President Reagan and Gorbachev in Iceland. The neighborhood started getting ready for Halloween. Carved pumpkins appearing on porches and cardboard witches hanging in windows, and the temperature was dropping, especially in the evenings. In Corpus, the fall is damp and glomming. I laid out a pallet of blankets for Roscoe in the garage and started pouring warm water over his food. I used a copper-bottomed pot that Holly's father had left in the sink. I'd barely seen Matt since the day we talked about the bloodstain. He'd been skipping school a lot, and on those days when I did glimpse him in the hall, I hid behind my locker door or ducked into the bathroom. With the changing weather, he'd taken to wearing a plaid flannel shirt with his fatigues. He hung out on the smoker's patio in the mornings and afternoons. I called his house every night from Holly's banana phone and never said anything. Sometimes Matt hung up right away. Others he'd lay the receiver beside a radio he'd tuned to a Tejano station, or he'd read classified ads from Soldier of Fortune into the phone.
The survival knife you've been waiting for, 10-inch blade and hollow compass-topped handle. Bounty hunting is legal and profitable. Silent firepower, crossbows and slingshots. The duffel bag with all my warfare stuff was still in my room, and though I no longer expected Matt to take it away, I also hadn't unpacked it. So on the morning when he waved me over to the smoker's patio and said he'd pick up the duffel that afternoon, I should have been relieved. There were a few other students on the patio, sallow-skinned seniors I'd seen with Holly, and who'd always intimidated me. I was surprised by how easily Matt fit in, saddened by it. He was wearing his tiger-striped camos, towing out a cigarette with his combat boot. He blew smoke over his shoulder the way my mother sometimes did and said, "Is that cool? Jeff said he'd give me a ride." I threw it away, I said. "No way," he said, his voice light with disappointment, as if I'd forgotten his birthday. "I didn't think you were coming. I was tired of seeing it." "That really sucks, Josh." "And there wasn't a bloodstain," I said. "What?" "At Holly's house," I said. "Sam didn't shoot himself." "That's what this is about?" I looked. "There's no bloodstain," I said. "He burned himself with a pot of water. He'll probably have a skin graft." Matt nodded, his eyes downcast and thoughtful. A small wind picked up, wafting the acrid smell of put-out cigarettes. I thought Matt was thinking of something kind to say about Sam. Once when I got stung by an asp behind his house, he broke off a piece of aloe from his mother's plant and rubbed it on the wound. Now, though, he just grinned and said, "I bet his face looks like melted cheese, all stretched and gooey. He won't need a mask for Halloween." My fist connected right above Matt's temple. "Oh, shit," a girl said, and a crowd of smokers cinched around us. Before Matt knew what was happening, before I knew what was happening, I'd hit him again, on his mouth. Already there was blood on his teeth, in the corner of his lips. Then I was on top of him, and we were falling to the patio, and he was trying to cover his face with his forearms and saying, "Dude, come on, please, no." And I was waiting for someone to stop me, to pull me off of him, to save both of us. The principal called my mother at the dry cleaners to pick me up from school. He'd suspended me for 3 days. I expected her to be angry or embarrassed, but when I apologized to her, she said, "Oh, Joshy, we always thought that Matt was a twerp." We drove to the bayfront and sat on the seawall. Although we were out in the open, the bay seething in front of us, the dock sailboats bobbing in the marina to the west, I felt as if we were hiding, staking out a place to plot our next move. The tide heaved. Waves walloped the barnacled pylons. Their dirty foam spread and dissolved. Eventually a crisp, salted wind nosed ashore, and my mother scooted closer to me. I kept expecting her to light a cigarette. "Sometimes I snoop in the Hensley house," I said. "I know." "You do?" "I watch your little flashlight beam from our window," she said. "It reminds me of a fly trying to get out." "I don't take anything," I said. "I just look." "I know that, too." A white gull hovered over us, then banked off and wheeled over the surf. I could hear cables clanging against hollow masts in the marina, the wind soughing through the dry palm trees that loomed along the seawall. Behind us stood the bayfront auditorium where the gun expos took place. My knuckles ached. "Dad says Sam might look different when he comes home," I said. My mother nodded. She was watching the gull. It had landed on a pylon, its head moving around in twitches. Annie said I should stay away from Holly. "Her life's already sewn up," she said, her gaze still trained on the gull. "Matt's is too, and now probably Sam's." "I don't understand," I said. "Good," my mother said, resting her head on my shoulder. "Good, I'm glad." Now I think of 1986 as the year my life pivoted away from what it had been, maybe the year when all of our lives pivoted. It was a year my parents spoke in low, furtive tones, and I strained to hear what they weren't saying. It was a year I surrendered the weapons of my youth. The morning after I fought Matt, I did throw out my duffel bag, and the year Holly Hensley shocked everyone by dropping out of school and joining the Coast Guard. This happened right after Thanksgiving. Her enlisting, I remember, was met with disillusionment and disdain. It seemed selfish and rash, but she found her footing in the military and enjoyed a distinguished career. After the Coast Guard, she moved to the Army and was stationed in Hawaii, Guam, and until her chopper went down 2 days ago, Afghanistan. According to the short obituary my mother just emailed me, Holly is survived by 2 sons and a husband, and she achieved the rank of staff sergeant. I hadn't seen her in almost 20 years. Funeral arrangements are being made in Corpus. I'll send flowers, and if I can find it, I'll make a copy of the Orange Grove photo and mail it to her family. The night after I got suspended, I decided to steal that picture of Holly and her brother. I had been lying on my bed earlier that day. My father had taken away my stereo and television privileges, and until my suspension ended, I was only allowed out of the house to feed Roscoe, and I thought having the Orange Grove photograph might quell my desire to sneak into Holly's room. I'd also started thinking Mr. Hensley would return soon, so my access to the house felt fleeting, like a journey to a foreign country. A deployment was coming to an end. I wanted a souvenir. The moon was full that night, lamping the Hensley's backyard and rimming the curtains in Holly's room. Everything else lay in deep shadow. I clicked my flashlight on and off to see and wondered if my mother was watching from across the street. I suspected she was and didn't mind. The house still smelled of potpourri, a little dank. I debated over grabbing another picture from Holly's parents' room to replace the one I wanted to take, but finally decided I'd just cluster the remaining three photos and hope Holly would have forgotten what had been there before. It seemed possible. I was standing in front of her dresser trying to visualize the most inconspicuous way to rearrange the pictures, when from behind me I heard, "What's buzzin', cousin?" I spun around, knocked into the dresser. The frames toppled. My heart kicked in my chest. Holly was on her bed, lying on her side among the stuffed animals. Even when I looked straight at her, her image was obscured in the dark. "I didn't take anything," I said. "You should have," she said. "I would. I just like the picture of you and Sam in the orange grove." "I do too," she said. "What you can't see is that the oranges are frozen solid. It was last year, right before we came back, and there was this massive cold snap that killed everything." I clasped my hands behind my back. They were trembling again. I said, "I'm sorry for sneak." "We're alone here, if you're wondering," she said, shifting on the bed. "My parents are still in Houston with Sam. Julio came to get me. If I don't go back to school, I won't graduate." "I'm suspended," I said. "And Matt's a bloody mess." "You heard?" "I heard you were defending Sam," she said. "I almost went to your house to thank you, but then I saw the grass clippings on the carpet and figured you'd be back." "I never looked in your drawers," I said. "You'll do better next time," she said. A raft of clouds floated past the moon, shrouding the room for a moment. I looked at the ceiling and couldn't see it. I could hear myself breathing. "I wanted the Orange Grove picture," I said. "I was going to steal it." "You can't have that one, but I'll make you a copy," she said. "Want anything else?" "I want Sam to get better." "Me too. He's trying. Anything else?" "I want to know about Mr. Mitchell," I said. Holly rolled onto her back. She tossed a stuffed white bear into the air, caught it, then did it again. She said, "I'll tell you, but you only get three wishes. You sure this is how you want to use your last one?" I wasn't sure of anything at that moment. I felt as if I were balancing on a precipice and I needed to think clearly. I tried to imagine how disappointed my father would be if he knew where I was, tried to understand what my mother had meant about everyone's lives being sewn up. I thought of how Sam used Holly's sweatshirt for a blanket and the baseball cap she'd given him for his birthday. I wondered how it would feel to live outside Texas, what it would be like to walk through a frozen orange grove or to douse yourself with boiling water or to see your young son lying in a coma and not recognize him. And then, like that, I understood. Before I could stop myself, I said, "He's yours, isn't he? Sam is." Holly tossed the bear again higher. In the air it spiraled and looked like a silver fish flashing through the murky water. She did it again, higher still. I thought she was trying to hit the ceiling I could barely see. "That's why you went to Florida," I said. "Your parents didn't want..." "Josh," she said. "Yes?" "Stop talking," she said. "I won't tell anyone." "Come here," Holly said. "Just come here." I thought I would lie beside her and she would whisper the trajectory of Sam's life to me, explain who else knew her secrets and who his father was. It gave me a sensation of inertia, of countless mysteries parting around me like currents. But Holly offered none of this. She just lifted the comforter and I took off my shoes and she pulled me on top of her. We kicked her stuffed animals to the carpet, stripped off our clothes, tangled into each other. Roscoe barked in the backyard and ran along the fence. Holly said, "He chases possums." The house groaned. I shivered. I thought of the Luger in her parents' bedroom and wondered where Matt was at that late hour. I worried my father would come looking for me, but also felt certain my mother would run interference. Soon Holly said, "I just want him to be okay," and started sobbing against my chest. I was 14 years old, scared and inexperienced and mystified by the luck of my life, and though I could think of nothing to say, I held her close, as tight as I could. Eventually her breathing slowed so completely I wondered if she'd gone to sleep. I hoped so. I was wide awake, my eyes open and adjusted to the darkness. The edges of her curtains were again framed in moonlight, and in the shallow glow our skin looked new and smooth and unblemished, ready for the scars that were lying somewhere in ambush. And that story was Soldier of Fortune by Brett Anthony Johnston, from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Lori Moore. Diem Perdidi by Julie Otsuka. She remembers her name. She remembers the name of the president. She remembers the name of the president's dog. She remembers what city she lives in, and on which street, and in which house, the one with the big olive tree where the road takes a turn. She remembers what year it is. She remembers the season. She remembers the day on which you were born. She remembers the daughter who was born before you. She had your father's nose. That was the first thing I noticed about her. But she does not remember that daughter's name. She remembers the name of the man she did not marry, Frank, and she keeps his letters in a drawer by her bed. She remembers that you once had a husband, but she refuses to remember your ex-husband's name. That man, she calls him. She does not remember how she got the bruises on her arms or going for a walk with you earlier this morning. She does not remember bending over during that walk and plucking a flower from a neighbor's front yard and slipping it into her hair. Maybe your father will kiss me now. She does not remember what she ate for dinner last night or when she last took her medicine. She does not remember to drink enough water. She does not remember to comb her hair. She remembers the rows of dried persimmons that once hung from the eaves of her mother's house in Berkeley. They were the most beautiful shade of orange. She remembers that your father loves peaches. She remembers that every Sunday morning at 10 he takes her for a drive down to the sea in the brown car. She remembers that every evening, right before the 8 o'clock news, he sets out 2 fortune cookies on a paper plate and announces to her that they are having a party. She remembers that on Mondays he comes home from the college at 4, and if he is even 5 minutes late, she goes out to the gate and begins to wait for him. She remembers which bedroom is hers and which is his. She remembers that the bedroom that is now hers was once yours. She remembers that it wasn't always like this. She remembers the first line of the song, How High the Moon. She remembers the Pledge of Allegiance. She remembers her Social Security number. She remembers her best friend Jean's telephone number, even though Jean has been dead for 6 years. She remembers that Margaret is dead. She remembers that Betty is dead. She remembers that Grace has stopped calling. She remembers that her own mother died 9 years ago while spading the soil in her garden, and she misses her more and more every day. It doesn't go away. She remembers the number assigned to her family by the government right after the start of the war, 13611. She remembers being sent away to the desert with her mother and brother during the 5th month of that war and taking her first ride on a train. She remembers the day they came home, September 9, 1945. She remembers the sound of the wind hissing through the sagebrush. She remembers the scorpions and red ants. She remembers the taste of dust. Whenever you stop to see her, she remembers to give you a big hug, and you're always surprised at her strength. She remembers to give you a kiss every time you leave. She remembers to tell you at the end of every phone call that the FBI will check up on you again soon. She remembers to ask you if you would like her to iron your blouse for you before you go out on a date. She remembers to smooth down your skirt. Don't give it all away. She remembers to brush aside a wayward strand of your hair. She does not remember eating lunch with you 20 minutes ago and suggests that you go out to Marie Callender's for sandwiches and pie. She does not remember that she herself once used to make the most beautiful pies with perfectly fluted crusts. She does not remember how to iron your blouse for you or when she began to forget. Something's changed. She does not remember what she's supposed to do next. She remembers that the daughter who was born before you lived for 30 minutes and then died. She looked perfect from the outside. She remembers her mother telling her more than once, "Don't you ever let anyone see you cry." She remembers giving you your first bath on your 3rd day in the world. She remembers that you were a very fat baby. She remembers that your first word was no. She remembers picking apples in a field with Frank many years ago in the rain. It was the best day of my life. She remembers that the first time she met him, she was so nervous she forgot her own address. She remembers wearing too much lipstick. She remembers not sleeping for days. When you drive past Hess Park, she remembers being asked to leave her exercise class by her teacher after being in that class for more than 10 years. I shouldn't have talked so much. She remembers touching her toes and doing windmills and jumping jacks on the freshly mown grass. She remembers being the highest kicker in her class. She does not remember how to use the new coffee maker, which is now 3 years old, because it was bought right after she began to forget. She does not remember asking your father 10 minutes ago if today is Sunday, or if it is time to go for her ride. She does not remember where she last put her sweater or how long she'd been sitting in her chair. She does not always remember how to get out of that chair, and so you gently push down on the footrest and offer her your hand, which she does not always remember to take. "Go away," she sometimes says. Other times she just says, "I'm stuck." She does not remember saying to you the other night, right after your father left the room, "He loves me more than I love him." She does not remember saying to you a moment later, "I can hardly wait until he comes back." She remembers that when your father was courting her, he was always on time. She remembers thinking that he had a nice smile. He still does. She remembers that when they first met, he was engaged to another woman. She remembers that the other woman was white. She remembers that the other woman's parents did not want their daughter to marry a man who looked like the gardener. She remembers that the winters were colder back then, and that there were days on which you actually had to put on a coat and scarf. She remembers her mother bowing her head every morning at the altar and offering her ancestors a bowl of hot rice. She remembers the smell of incense and pickled cabbage in the kitchen. She remembers that her father always wore nice shoes. She remembers that the night the FBI came for him, he and her mother had just had another big fight. She remembers not seeing him again until after the end of the war. She does not always remember to trim her toenails, and when you soak her feet in the bucket of warm water, she closes her eyes and leans back in her chair and reaches out for your hand. "Don't give up on me." She does not remember how to tie her shoelaces or fasten the hooks on her bra. She does not remember that she has been wearing her favorite blue blouse for 5 days in a row. She does not remember your age. "Just wait till you have children of your own," she says to you, even though you're now too old to do so. She remembers that after the first girl was born and then died, she sat in the yard for days, just staring at the roses by the pond. "I didn't know what else to do." She remembers that when you were born, you too had your father's long nose. It was as if I'd given birth to the same girl twice. She remembers that you are a Taurus. She remembers that your birthstone is green. She remembers to read you your horoscope from the newspaper whenever you come over to see her. Someone you were once very close to may soon reappear in your life, she tells you. She does not remember reading you that same horoscope 5 minutes ago or going to the doctor with you last week after you discovered a bump on the back of her head. "I think I fell." She does not remember telling the doctor that you are no longer married or giving him your number and asking him to please call. She does not remember leaning over and whispering to you the moment he stepped out of the room, "I think he'll do." She remembers another doctor asking her 50 years ago, minutes after the first girl was born and then died, if she wanted to donate the baby's body to science. He said she had a very unusual heart. She remembers being in labor for 32 hours. She remembers being too tired to think. "So I told him yes." She remembers driving home from the hospital in the sky-blue Chevy with your father and neither one of them saying a word. She remembers knowing she'd made a big mistake. She does not remember what happened to the baby's body and worries that it might be stuck in a jar. She does not remember why they didn't just bury her. "I wish she was under a tree." She remembers wanting to bring her flowers every day. She remembers that even as a young girl, you said you did not want to have children. She remembers that you hated wearing dresses. She remembers that you never played with dolls. She remembers that the first time you bled, you were 13 years old and wearing bright yellow pants. She remembers that your childhood dog was named Shiro. She remembers that you once had a cat named Gasoline. She remembers that you had two turtles named Turtle. She remembers that the first time she and your father took you to Japan to meet his family, you were 18 months old and just beginning to speak.
She remembers leaving you with his mother in the tiny silkworm village in the mountains while she and your father traveled across the island for 10 days. I worried about you the whole time. She remembers that when they came back, you did not know who she was, and that for many days afterward you would not speak to her. You would only whisper in her ear. She remembers that the year you turned 5, you refused to leave the house without tapping the door frame 3 times. She remembers that you had a habit of clicking your teeth repeatedly, which drove her up the wall. She remembers that you could not stand it when different colored foods were touching on the plate. Everything had to be just so. She remembers trying to teach you to read before you were ready. She remembers taking you to Newberry's to pick out patterns in fabric and teaching you how to sew. She remembers that every night after dinner you would sit down next to her at the kitchen table and hand her the bobby pins one by one as she set the curlers in her hair. She remembers that this was her favorite part of the day. I wanted to be with you all the time. She remembers that you were conceived on the first try. She remembers that your brother was conceived on the first try. She remembers that your other brother was conceived on the second try. We must not have been paying attention. She remembers that a palm reader once told her that she would never be able to bear children because her uterus was tipped the wrong way. She remembers that a blind fortune teller once told her that she had been a man in her past life and that Frank had been her sister. She remembers that everything she remembers is not necessarily true. She remembers the horse-drawn garbage carts on Ashby, her first pair of crepe-soled shoes, scattered flowers by the side of the road. She remembers that the sound of Frank's voice always made her feel calmer. She remembers that every time they parted, he turned around and watched her walk away. She remembers that the first time he asked her to marry him, she told him she wasn't ready. She remembers that the second time she said she wanted to wait till she was finished with school. She remembers walking along the water with him one warm summer evening on the boardwalk and being so happy she could not remember her own name. She remembers not knowing that it wouldn't be like this with any of the others. She remembers thinking she had all the time in the world. She does not remember the names of the flowers in the yard whose names she has known for years. Roses? Daffodils? Immortelles? She does not remember that today is Sunday and she's already gone for her ride. She does not remember to call you, even though she always says that she will. She remembers how to play Clair de Lune on the piano. She remembers how to play chopsticks and scales. She remembers not to talk to telemarketers when they call on the telephone. We're not interested. She remembers her grammar, just between you and me. She remembers her manners. She remembers to say thank you and please. She remembers to wipe herself every time she uses the toilet. She remembers to flush. She remembers to turn her wedding ring around whenever she pulls on her silk stockings. She remembers to reapply her lipstick every time she leaves the house. She remembers to put on her anti-wrinkle cream every night before climbing into bed. It works while you sleep. In the morning when she wakes, she remembers her dreams. I was walking through a forest. I was swimming in a river. I was looking for Frank in a city I did not know, and no one would tell me where he was. On Halloween day, she remembers to ask you if you're going out trick-or-treating. She remembers that your father hates pumpkin. It's all he ate in Japan during the war. She remembers listening to him pray every night when they first got married that he would be the one to die first. She remembers playing marbles in a dirt floor in the desert with her brother and listening to the couple at night on the other side of the wall. They were at it all the time. She remembers the box of chocolates you brought back to her after your honeymoon in Paris. But will it last? You asked her. She remembers her own mother telling her, the moment you fall in love with someone, you are lost. She remembers that when her father came back after the war, he and her mother fought even more than they had before. She remembers that he would spend entire days shopping for shoes in San Francisco while her mother scrubbed other people's floors. She remembers that some nights he would walk around the block 3 times before coming into the house. She remembers that one night he did not come in at all. She remembers that when your own husband left you 5 years ago, you broke out in hives all over your body for weeks. She remembers thinking he was trouble the moment she met him. A mother knows. She remembers keeping that thought to herself. I had to let you make your own mistakes. She remembers that of her 3 children, you were the most delightful to be with. She remembers that your younger brother was so quiet she sometimes forgot he was there. He was like a dream. She remembers that her own brother refused to carry anything with him onto the train except for his rubber toy truck. He wouldn't let me touch it. She remembers her mother killing all the chickens in the yard the day before they left. She remembers her fifth-grade teacher, Mr. Martello, asking her to stand up in front of the class so everyone could tell her goodbye. She remembers being given a silver heart pendant by her next-door neighbor, Elaine Crowley, who promised to write but never did. She remembers losing that pendant on the train and being so angry she wanted to cry. It was my first piece of jewelry. She remembers that 1 month after Frank joined the Air Force, he suddenly stopped writing her letters. She remembers worrying that he'd been shot down over Korea or taken hostage by guerrillas in the jungle. She remembers thinking about him every minute of the day. I thought I was losing my mind. She remembers learning from a friend one night that he'd fallen in love with somebody else. She remembers asking your father the next day to marry her. "Shall we go get the ring?" I said to him. She remembers telling him, "It's time." When you take her to the supermarket, she remembers that coffee is aisle 2. She remembers that aisle 3 is milk. She remembers the name of the cashier in the express lane who always gives her a big hug. Diane. She remembers the name of the girl at the flower stand who always gives her a single broken-stemmed rose. She remembers that the man behind the meat counter is Big Lou. "Well, hello, gorgeous," he says to her. She does not remember where her purse is and begins to panic until you remind her that she's left it at home. "I don't feel like myself without it." She does not remember asking the man in line behind her whether or not he was married. She does not remember him telling her rudely that he was not. She does not remember staring at the old woman in the wheelchair by the melons and whispering to you, "I hope I never end up like that." She remembers that the huge mimosa tree that once stood next to the cart corral in the parking lot is no longer there. Nothing stays the same. She remembers that she was once a very good driver. She remembers failing her last driver's test 3 times in a row. I couldn't remember any of the rules. She remembers that the day after her father left them, her mother sprinkled little piles of salt in the corner of every room to purify the house. She remembers that they never spoke of him again. She does not remember asking your father, when he comes home from the pharmacy, what took him so long, or who he talked to, or whether or not the pharmacist was pretty. She does not always remember his name. She remembers graduating from high school with high honors in Latin. She remembers how to say, "I came, I saw, I conquered. Veni, vidi, vici." She remembers how to say, "I have lost the day. Diem perditi." She remembers the words, "for I'm sorry," in Japanese, which you have not heard her utter in years. She remembers the words for rice and toilet. She remembers the words for wait, chotto mate kudaisai. She remembers that a white snake dream will bring you good luck. She remembers that it's bad luck to pick up a dropped comb. She remembers that you should never run to a funeral. She remembers that you shout the truth down into a well. She remembers going to work, like her mother, for the rich white ladies up in the hills. She remembers Mrs. Tyndall, who insisted on eating lunch with her every day in the kitchen instead of just leaving her alone. She remembers Mrs. Edward DeVries, who fired her after 1 day. "Who taught you how to iron?" she asked me. She remembers that Mrs. Cavanaugh would not let her go home on Saturdays until she had baked an apple pie. She remembers Mrs. Cavanaugh's husband, Arthur, who liked to put his hand on her knee. She remembers that he sometimes gave her money. She remembers that she never refused. She remembers once stealing a silver candlestick from a cupboard, but she cannot remember whose it was. She remembers that they never missed it. She remembers using the same napkin for 3 days in a row. She remembers that today is Sunday, which 6 days out of 7 is not true. When you bring home the man you hope will become your next husband, she remembers to take his jacket. She remembers to offer him coffee. She remembers to offer him cake. She remembers to thank him for the roses. "So you like her?" she asks him. She remembers to ask him his name. "She's my firstborn, you know." She remembers 5 minutes later that she's already forgotten his name and asks him again what it is. "That's my brother's name," she tells him. She does not remember talking to her brother on the phone earlier that morning. "He promised me he'd call, or going for a walk with you in the park." She does not remember how to make coffee. She does not remember how to serve cake. She remembers sitting next to her brother many years ago in a train to the desert and fighting about who got to lie down on the seat. She remembers hot white sand, the wind on the water, someone's voice telling her, "Hush, it's all right." She remembers where she was the day the men landed on the moon. She remembers the day that they learned that Japan had lost the war. It was the only time I ever saw my mother cry. She remembers the day she learned that Frank had married somebody else. I read about it in the paper.
She remembers a letter she got from him not long after, asking if he could please see her. He said he'd made a mistake. She remembers writing him back, "It's too late." She remembers marrying your father on an unusually warm day in December. She remembers having their first fight 3 months later in March. I threw a chair. She remembers that he comes home from the college every Monday at 4. She remembers that she's forgetting. She remembers less and less every day. When you ask her your name, she does not remember what it is. Ask your father, he'll know. She does not remember the name of the president. She does not remember the name of the president's dog. She does not remember the season. She does not remember the day or the year. She remembers the little house on San Luis Avenue that she first lived in with your father. She remembers her mother leaning over the bed she once shared with her brother and kissing the two of them good night. She remembers that as soon as the first girl was born, she knew that something was wrong. She didn't cry. She remembers holding the baby in her arms and watching her go to sleep for the first and last time in her life. She remembers that they never buried her. She remembers that they did not give her a name. She remembers that the baby had perfect fingernails and a very unusual heart. She remembers that she had your father's long nose. She remembers knowing at once that she was his. She remembers beginning to bleed 2 days later when she came home from the hospital. She remembers your father catching her in the bathroom as she began to fall. She remembers a desert sky at sunset. It was the most beautiful shade of orange. She remembers scorpions and red ants. She remembers the taste of dust. She remembers once loving someone more than anyone else. She remembers giving birth to the same girl twice. She remembers that today is Sunday and it's time to go for her ride, and so she picks up her purse and puts on her lipstick and goes out to wait for your father in the car. And that story was Diem Perdidi by Julie Otsuka from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.